Welcome back to the Sports Marketing Scotland podcast. I'm Chris Sampson. If you haven't listened to episode 2 with Claire Nelson from Netball Scotland and Strathclyde Sirens, I would really recommend you do either before you listen to this one or after. It was absolutely brilliant, if I don't say so myself, and left me properly inspired about sport's power to connect and engage with people. This episode is with Ross Dunbar. Duncan recommended I get him on the podcast on episode 1, so I thought, what better time than now? If you don't follow Ross on Twitter, then I think you should. Firstly, he's at RossDunbar93, and he's always sharing some good insights that clubs across Scotland could use to improve themselves. He's currently Union Berlin's digital media manager, and we touched on his current role and obviously had a good chat about all things Scottish football marketing too. Enjoy the podcast. Ross, welcome to the podcast. Can you just introduce yourself for everybody listening?
Yeah, thanks very much for the invite. My name is Ross Dunbar. I'm the digital media manager at Union Berlin. I've been in Germany for 7.5 years, firstly working on the media side, and then since 2017 I've been at the club and building up their international strategy and helping the club develop on various digital platforms, both in English and in German.
Nice one. And you mentioned the media side there. What was your experiences from that perspective before you joined Union?
Yeah, it was great. I mean, obviously at the time, I think the Bundesliga was not that prominent in the UK. I always have this conversation, which I think people maybe of a certain age maybe struggle to realise, that, you know, even 10 years ago, the Bundesliga wasn't a particularly prominent league in the UK. And at that time, it was much easier to obviously get access to players and staff. There are a lot of different interviews with coaches and players, and that obviously was a really good experience, just to come in and try something different, get a kind of feel for different culture, different environment. And yeah, a lot of the things went really, really well. Obviously when I was at Deutsche Welle, I had a good experience building up the sports department there, and yeah, I think a lot of invaluable experience that I might not have got probably staying in the UK.
I guess your kind of path over there is quite unique as a Scottish person living over in Germany. Obviously, there's a few other examples too, but kind of what made you take that path, and then what advice would you give to anybody looking to do something similar?
Yeah, I also had a curiosity about different leagues and different different styles of football, different experiences. And yeah, I think it's kind of the nature of the country we grew up in, right? That it's a small country, a small media country, so it's always natural that at some point in someone's career you probably try and go abroad or try and go down south and try something different, right? And yeah, my advice to people is, you know, just go and do it, right? What's the worst that can happen? I think everybody struggles with that thing of like, oh, do I change job? Do I do this? Do I do that? And it's always a question of risk, right? And everything you do, there's always a question of risk. But I think once you kind of get over the sort of initial fear of, oh my god, what's going to happen here, eventually, you know, what's the worst thing that can happen? Probably not that much, as long as you don't run out of money. That's probably the most important thing, right? But I think probably for a lot of young people coming into the media industry, it's, you know, the most important thing is going and finding your own way, right? You've got all the tools and all the platforms. You know, we're doing this podcast now. You know, 20 years ago that just would not be possible. So anybody can create content, they can have their own destiny in their own hands, and they can go and do whatever they want to, so they don't really have to be guided by what maybe they've either been told or what they've maybe seen other people do in the past.
I was going to ask you about that. Obviously, you pointed out that we're doing this podcast right now and it wasn't possible before, but do you think it kind of now more than ever it's easier for people to make these same kind of moves into different career paths or different countries?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, obviously, it's, you know, Brexit's kind of thrown up different challenges now, so that's the elephant in the room, obviously. But you know, if you want to be the UK's next big basketball correspondent, you can do it, right? Like, there's nothing to stop you. You can create your own website, you can create your own platforms, you can basically be your own media business, right? There's a lot of good examples, I think, even in Scottish football, where it's a small media market, but you know, you're obviously producing podcasts for a long time that are great, and the guys at the Terrace are doing fantastic stuff on Patreon. 2.1 are doing some stuff with data and analytics. So there's a lot of really good examples of independent media companies that are springing up. And I think, like, nowadays, even though it might seem that there's a lot of competition, there's also a lot of appetite for content, right? So even if there are other people in your space, it doesn't mean that people don't want to listen to your opinion either.
Yeah, that's true. I guess like sometimes it, from my even a personal perspective, it can feel a bit overwhelming sometimes, all the content that's being produced. But there is, as you say, that appetite. And it, I was just actually talking to Michael, actually, who obviously I used to co-host the other podcast with, and I was saying that I'd stumbled across kind of somebody's podcast or Twitter account that seemed to have a very big following that I'd never actually come across before in my life. And I was like, it's that kind of thing that can actually happen these days. You don't know about every single thing that happens.
Yeah, exactly, right, exactly. There's loads of these independent companies springing up all the time. Like, even if you look at fan media as well, there's a lot of, I think even like Hearts or Hibs, even there's 3-4 various fan podcasts, yeah. Heart and Hand podcast with Rangers, Celtic State of Mind. You know, there's a lot of these independent media companies springing up, and I think it's great to see, because I think there's a lot of different perspectives out there. And I think any budding journalist, and again, it doesn't have to be a young journalist, right? It can be somebody, you know, middle of their career. It can be somebody, you know, who's in a different job and wants to pivot into something else, right? The opportunities and the platforms are there just to make it, you know, easier than it ever has been to try something different.
Yeah, we'll circle back into Scottish football a little bit later on, but I did want to touch on kind of the Bundesliga and your current role at Union Berlin as well. How has the league been this season? Obviously, it's been such a strange season from a fan perspective and a player perspective, and probably even more so from you working in it.
Yeah, this is going to make me sound absolutely terrible, but even attending the games are just really boring, like, to watch as a spectacle, right? There's no atmosphere, there's no kind of oomph to the games. It is a bit of a training spectacle for us at home, especially when you compare it to the first season we had in the Bundesliga, or even the promotion season. I mean, when the stadium's packed, it just makes a huge difference. Obviously, you know, the weekend of recording, we have the chance to have fans back in the stadium, so that's great. And everyone says obviously second season in the league as a newly promoted team is the most dangerous, right? Because you've gone through that sort of first year of playing cup finals every week, but we've done really, really well and have a chance to play European football. And I think if you'd offered anybody the chance to be safe of relegation by the end of the season, they would have taken it. So I think the club has the second lowest budget in the league, which is quite incredible when you think of where they are and the teams that they've beaten both home and away. So yeah, progress is really good, but again, summer comes in, players leave, you've always got to try and rebuild. So, it's been a really impressive journey so far.
How's it been from that kind of newly promoted club over the past, well, obviously last season and then this season being in the league and not being a newly promoted club? How's that helped you in your role?
It's a good question. I mean, I think a big part of obviously the pandemic has changed a lot of how we work, right? You know, when I started, I had quite a clear remit of developing the club's international strategy. There wasn't really one in place, and the club had never really considered, you know, what opportunities there were there. And obviously, we all know that, you know, a couple of years ago, there was this big trend of British fans going to Germany, having a weekend, you know, having a city break and going to the game, right? And I think that's where Union Berlin probably wanted to position themselves. That has kind of been blown out of the window a little bit. When you go into the Bundesliga, you know, you're not just talking about one specific market like the UK. I mean, we have just so much interest from around the world. Like, you know, I must get so many emails every day from some fans that we have in Indonesia, you know, through our podcast who just adopted us as one of their teams. You know, they had this podcast in Indonesia, can't remember the name of it, I think it's Box to Box, and they adopted Union Berlin as their team. And all of a sudden, we just had this huge wave of interest that, you know, we never really thought about. We have a Japanese player, so again, you know, that brings another level of dynamic. So it's very difficult when you're in that sort of level of competition just to stay either locally based or regionally based. It's just the nature of the beast right now that I think the way the club's playing, the story of the club, the fact that, you know, like I said, second lowest budget in the league, and yet we're still competing with Borussia Dortmund and Bayern Munich and Leipzig. People like an underdog story, right? So it resonates all over the world, which obviously that feeds into what kind of digital strategy you have. Are you trying to be funny on social media? Are you trying to sell t-shirts? Are you trying to sell jerseys? We've got Adidas now as one of our partners, so again, that again really helps us to scale, right? Before, we didn't really have that sort of power, but I think now we're in a much better position to deal with those kind of challenges.
you did mention in terms of that kind of shift in the mindset of the club, almost from that kind of being a destination for English fans or British fans to come over for the weekend. But now that that has shifted a little bit, I guess my question on that would be, what is the strategy now? And Union are a club that has such strong values as well. What are they? Could you take us through them? And how does that fit into what you do in your role?
Yeah, so yeah, the club's values are really, really strong. I mean, I get asked a lot, is Union Berlin a little bit like St. Pauli? And it probably isn't. St. Pauli has different values to Union Berlin. Union Berlin is definitely much more of a, I would say, 100% football focused, in the sense that, you know, we stand for, you know, cheap ticket prices, terracing in the stadium, 50+1, all that kind of thing. So I think the challenge is that obviously there is that sort of, you're getting pulled almost in two ways, right? You're getting pulled on one side from the point of view of staying really local, and then you're getting pulled on the other side from, okay, maybe we need to obviously try and look more internationally to increase our revenue so that we can be more competitive. And I think finding that balance is really difficult. But I think it's also a case of digging down on what you're good at, right? And for Union Berlin, it wouldn't make sense to sell us as a place where there's superstars. It wouldn't make sense for us to probably sell ourselves as a quirky kind of left field kind of club. We have our values, which is kind of getting people into the stadium, selling memberships, and having a democratic way of running the club. And that's kind of where we stand. Obviously, this year has kind of brought that a lot of that into perspective with the European Super League. So we've been able to sort of dig down on that as well, which kind of helps us. But I think it's just about, like, it's about having your values and having your sort of DNA and then being able to export that in different markets, right? And not the other way around and thinking, okay, well, we have to come up with a strategy.
It kind of sounds like it's the perfect example of what people think is a perfect German football club, almost, with obviously trying to get as many fans in the stadium, not kind of flaunting the 50+1 in any way. Again, you don't need to get into that too much, but and not really kind of massively spending the way to success as well. It does seem like it's almost like made for you to get close to fans and to get fans on board with those values and the vision of the club as well.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think the interesting thing for us is, and I don't really know how to compare it to a lot of other teams in Germany. I'm sure there's a lot of other clubs in Germany that experience the same thing, and it's probably the same also in other countries. But I think even though we have, let's say, 10,000 season ticket holders only, our engagement levels with them are much, much higher, in the sense that, you know, they probably buy more merchandise from us. They probably buy more in terms of, like, the club's TV channel. They buy a membership. They engage in terms of the running in the club. So even though the numbers are probably a lot smaller than other German clubs, I think the level of engagement is much, much higher. And I think trying to maintain that balance when you play in the Bundesliga is obviously extremely difficult. But I think if the club stays kind of true to those principles and stays true to those values, even if you have one season where you might not play that well, I think the fans will still stick behind you and you'll still have that kind of support going forward.
Your role then, in terms of being across digital media, what actually does that entail on a daily basis? Because I know that kind of some roles across other clubs might be all-encompassing, but take us through what your remit is.
Yeah, it's really broad, to be honest. I mean, obviously, when you start talking about, like, international stuff, just on one side, you know, you have to deal with, you know, merchandising, for example. We have a system where we have to get everything that's in German and English, obviously, on the merchandising side. We have to, obviously, from a marketing point of view, we have targeted marketing to certain regions, offering certain packages to certain people. We do the same with ticketing. As you can imagine, we get so many requests for tickets that we can't really fulfill. And then you go into the sponsoring side. That's kind of quite a nascent thing. We haven't really got that many international partners, but it's certainly something that's on the agenda right now, because we've developed that sort of international community. Now we actually have something that we can sell. We can actually try and bring partners on board. Obviously, there's a social media side, there's the content side, dealing a lot with the press office side as well. We have a lot of, obviously, international media teams coming to the stadium, whether it's with the Bundesliga themselves or whether it's elsewhere. So it's actually a really broad remit in terms of there's not really one thing I could pigeonhole into one day. I mean, the most simplest part of it is really around the games. Normally around the games, it's mostly content focused. And then at the start of the week, it's a lot more sort of big picture, longer term sort of things that are in place.
Do you have, this is actually quite a, well, I'm going to say hot topic, but I guess the online rule kind of published a kind of survey recently, and it looked as though the majority of respondents to that didn't have a kind of social media strategy documented. Is there something in place at Union Berlin?
No, there isn't actually. No, there isn't. We have quite a flat structure in the sense that everybody kind of does their own thing. You know, we have I would say probably about 10, 12 people in our department for communications and media, and obviously everybody has their area of expertise. So we all just kind of come together and kind of agree on what kind of themes we're going with, what kind of designs we're going with, what kind of voice are we going with, what are we kind of trying working towards, and then from there it's a case of, right, well, everybody go and do their own thing. So we're not really that focused on getting things down on paper. We're probably, I'm sure a lot of people who work at the bigger clubs would come in and probably be quite shocked by maybe how we do things in terms of the culture, the working culture. We like to have quite a small team. We socialise together, we go to the pub together, we drink together. It's quite a small team, but I think that really works because we all understand kind of what we're trying to work towards. And everybody at the club who is in our department anyway all agrees on the sort of values and the strategy for the club, right? So there's nobody in the club that thinks Union Berlin should go and play in New York for a Bundesliga game, right? There's nobody who thinks like that, you know what I mean? Like, everyone kind of has the same idea. Most people are members, most people are local fans, so there's not really any sort of divergence on that side.
I find that super interesting because, and I guess if I'm thinking about it, it probably stems back to, like you said, those values. If a lot of the people working there are members, if they're fans of the club, then like they just inherently know what the club is all about, and nothing needs to be down on paper from a marketing perspective or anything like that.
Yeah, spot on. Yeah, spot on. That's a good, really good way to put it. Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's almost kind of unspoken stuff or unwritten stuff, but I think when you're just part of that ecosystem, you kind of know what it is. Like, you know, nobody's turning up to Union Berlin game and taking a selfie stick, because the people who go to the games, they know what the values are of the club. They know that it's, you know, 100% get behind the team for 90 minutes. Nobody's booing the team off the pitch. That just doesn't happen. You know, everybody who I think is involved in it kind of gets it without really needing to be sort of told about it. But I think that's probably what makes it quite special as well, that you have a culture that you don't really have to reinforce. It's just kind of quite organic, right?
Yeah, totally. And in terms of the organic nature as well, we've touched on it a little bit already, but that kind of fan culture and the match day experience, how important is that at Union Berlin for you? And do you use it when you come to approach digital campaigns or anything like that?
Yeah, it's massive. Yeah, it's massive. I mean, I would say the stadium experience is probably, it's probably 80-90% of what we would be doing in terms of that sense. Like, if you look at any of our promotion materials, any of our marketing materials, you know, the stadium experience is what really underpins it. Do you know what I mean? Like, all the photos, all the videos, all the things that are there, it's all just from the stadium. It's not about star players. It's not about, you know, glitz and glamour or anything like that. You know, it's about you know, what happens in the stadium. And we've been quite lucky as well that, you know, in that, with that strategy, we have been quite lucky in the sense that, you know, getting promoted to the Bundesliga. I don't know if you remember watching the game, the playoff against Stuttgart, but the fans running on the pitch, the fans celebrating on the pitch, the players involved in it as well. You can create so much content from that and create so much extra value. We played Dortmund the second day of the season, the second week of the season, and, you know, we had the whole stadium decked in red t-shirts, and it was a really, yeah, it was like a cauldron. It was a really intense atmosphere, and, you know, all of these things just create so much unique value. I can think of like other examples, like we played Leipzig, and every fan who had a loved one who had passed away or had, you know, who wasn't there to see, obviously the club's main achievement in the last 50 years, they were able to like buy like a banner with their face on it. And I think when you have thousands of people holding up banners of, you know, people they've lost, whether it's friends or whether it's relatives, it does create quite an emotive and powerful experience, right? So I think through all of these things, it gives the club, I don't want to say like a mythology, that's probably the wrong way to look at it, but it certainly allows the culture to grow quite organically.
it definitely comes across that way from somebody from the outside looking in, and especially, again, just totally generalising here a little bit, and no offence to Union to throw them in with every single other Bundesliga club, but like I think from a British football fan perspective, I think that's why the Bundesliga appeals so much, because you kind of want football to be like what it is like in the Bundesliga, but I'm just not sure that that would work necessarily at the moment in English or Scottish or British football as a whole. What do you reckon about that?
I mean, there's obviously barriers to making it like that in terms of, you know, not being able to have a beer in the stadium or not being able to have like kind of old fashioned testing, although that does exist still at a lot of the smaller games. I always kind of compare like Union Berlin to Somerset Park. In terms of the setup of it, in terms of the sort of mm-hmm. vibe of it. So I think, like, it is possible. I mean, at the end of the day, every club has to just define, like, you know, what are we about? Doesn't have to be anything like, I mean, I know obviously Bohemians, you know, do a lot of stuff in terms of the community. That's a great example that you guys have brought up before. And even if you were to look at St. Pauli, it doesn't have to be political or anything like that. It just has to be like, okay, what do you want to stand for? Is it we're a community-driven club? We want to celebrate the area, we want to bring in local musicians, local artists, all that kind of thing. Like, I think, like, it is possible, and I think that plays a part into the Union Berlin culture as well. The stadium lends itself well to that experience, I think as well it's a case of, like, everybody who goes to the games, they know what the culture is, you know what I mean? Like, they know that they're getting behind the team 100%, and I think that's a big part of it as well. So everybody can obviously have their own version of it. And I think a lot of teams are trying that. Like, I think if you look at a lot of clubs, they are looking at Germany for inspiration. There are barriers to it, but I think, like, you can cherry pick the best things and try and make your own model to be as successful as it can be.
Moving on, Ross, in terms of Scottish football now, and you're obviously based in Germany, and you work for Union Berlin, but you do still take a massive interest, if anybody does follow you on social media, in the Scottish game. Probably related to that last point then, what should Scottish football be known for? How should we sell the game much better than we are?
Yeah, I mean, it's a good question. I mean, I think the way that football is going, modern football, and I don't want to sound like an old dad here. This is going to make me sound really, it's going to make me sound really old. But I think at the end of the day, it depends, you know, what do you want football to be? What do you actually want football to be, right? If people, you know, I know that a lot of people in Scottish football who are maybe on the outside, we talk about, like, we want to have a community-driven game, we want to have a game where the fans are playing a big role. Some people don't want that, right? Some people want to have a fancy chair, and they want to drink a fancy drink, and they want to watch good football, and they want to have star players, but you've got to define at least what you want, right? You know, you've got to actually have a clear sort of direction. It might not be that we want to have alcohol in the stadium, or we don't want to have lots of drunken people at the ground, and that's absolutely fine, you know. But I think you've just got to define what it is. I think the unique thing that Scottish football has, and I know that it's already been spoken about, is just the depth of interest. We, you know, if you compare Scotland to any other country in Europe, and I think that includes a lot of the bigger countries, the depth of interest just isn't there. You know, like, even in Scotland, okay, yeah, I think we saw this week, you've 44,000. Season tickets have been sold at Rangers already. 44,000 season tickets is incredible, right? But then at the other end of the scale, you still have 500 people or 600 people in a community who turn up and watch Albion Rovers every week. You know what I mean? Like, so at both ends of the spectrum, there's just this enormous passion for football that I think does make our game really unique. You need to obviously, like you say, you need to work out what you actually want to achieve, right? You need to work out, like, what makes football special? What do you want your football club to be like? And like I said, I think that's the unique thing about Scottish football compared to other countries, even bigger countries with, you know, bigger clubs, you know, bigger, more richer leagues, is that we just have a depth of interest that I think just doesn't really exist. And that lends itself to stories, it lends itself to characters, it lends itself to heritage and culture and memories and all this kind of thing. So these are the things we've got to try and lean into, right? And, you know, we can sell that not only to a domestic audience, but I think we can sell that as well to an international audience.
Talking on that, selling to domestic and international audiences, obviously the TV deal for Scottish football at the moment gets continuously brought up online. What's your thoughts on it? I have some specific thoughts, but I think mine is a bit of a swear word, so I don't want to. I want a clean I want a clean rating on this podcast. what do you reckon about the TV deal at the moment?
I don't think it's great, to be honest. I can totally understand the point of view of the clubs, and I can understand the point of view of the leagues that, you know, they want to guarantee a certain level of income for as long a period as possible. The challenge with that is that the media landscape is changing so much, and it's changing so quickly, that I think by 2024-25 we don't really know what media is going to look like, right? Whether it's OTT, whether it's direct to fans, whether it's we're watching games on Amazon, like, nobody has any idea of where it's going to look. So while I do understand the point of view, Scottish football's always going to be in this cycle of, I don't want to say mediocrity because that's a bit harsh, but I think we're always going to be in that cycle of not being able to invest in things and not being able to move forward, because we always have that constant cycle of we don't take any risks. I'm not saying that we should take huge risks, but I think there comes a point that Scottish football has to unlock its commercial potential to actually have any chance of being able to invest in better facilities, being able to invest in fan engagement, because right now the money just isn't there, right? The money's just not going to grow on trees. So at some point you've got to try and maximise that revenue stream, I think.
Yeah, it's a difficult one. It's almost, I don't want to say it's a catch-22, and like you said, you didn't want to say it's kind of accepting mediocrity as well, but it is such a difficult one. You want to kind of encourage it to come back to that last question I asked you in terms of trying to sell itself a little bit more. What do you think? Is it just that clubs are trying to kind of not take those risks almost, because at the end of the day it is them that is almost making this decision?
The question is, who's setting the agenda? Who says that 3 o'clock on a Saturday is the only time that we can have football and it's the only time we can't show games? Who says that 12:30 is the ideal time to watch a football game? You know, who says that if we show more games on the television, people aren't going to go? These are all things that just keep coming up. Like, if you compare the Scottish broadcasting deal or the Scottish sort of football media deals to other leagues in Europe, you know, this season, for example, we're not even going to have the full allotment of games, right? Which is 48 games. In Norway, they have 240 games a season. Denmark, 250 games a season. Sweden, 240 games a season. I don't really understand this kind of thought process that if we show more matches on the television, people aren't going to go. In fact, I see it the opposite way, that it's going to engage more people in Scottish football, because not like you know, if you show more games of the top 4 or 5 teams in the Premiership, it's not really going to impact whether you're a Dunfermline fan or a East Fife fan, right? You're still going to go and watch your team. You're still going to be engaged in your team, but you might take more interest in the local league as opposed to watching Match of the Day or watching, I don't know, some Premier League game on BT Sport, right? So at the end of the day, you've got to give people that opportunity. And I think, like you say, if you look at the depth of interest, even games in the Scottish Championship that are on TV in Scotland get really, really good numbers. So I don't really buy into that, and I think if we did unlock some of that potential, I think it would go a long way to actually giving the clubs some finance, some comfort to actually invest in things, because right now we are in that, like you said, catch-22 situation.
Moving on a little bit to what kind of clubs can control at the moment, even though they can't control what they do from a league perspective too, but where can they improve off the pitch the most at the moment, in your opinion?
So looking at off the pitch stuff, I think, like, for me, what's interesting, having looked at different models and looking at different sort of income streams that club have in different European leagues, I think what's interesting is that in Scotland we still have this culture of, you know, we sit in the pub until 5 minutes before kickoff, we go to the game, you might buy a pie, you might buy a Bovril, you don't really buy any other merchandise. And I think Duncan Mackay pointed that out in the last podcast, that, you know, there's no offering there to even go and buy scarves and gloves inside the ground when it's freezing in the middle of winter. And then we leave, you know, probably 5 minutes before the end of the game, and you go back to the pub again, right? So I think that is probably where there is most, like, short-term potential, trying to sort of open up that game day experience. Doesn't mean that we have to have 13-hour tailgates outside of Capello, right? It doesn't have to be that way, but it could be that, you know, we could have a fan zone at games, you could have licenses to sell alcohol outside the stadium, you can have different concessions, you know, you might have a fancy burger van there at the game, you might have, some Indian food, you might have some Chinese food, whatever, right? You might, you know, you're giving people a chance to come to the game, have a bit more of an experience at the stadium as opposed to just turning up 5 minutes and being herded in by stewards and police, right? It's not really an ideal experience. And I think if you look at, I mean, Denmark, for me, Denmark's actually one of the model countries right now in terms of what Scottish people can learn from. And I think if you look at a lot of the Danish teams, even at the lower end of the league, like, for example, Lyngby, Odense, even Midtjylland, who play in a bit of a village, they have fan zones outside their stadium. Brøndby's fan zone is obviously top class, and I'm pretty sure Duncan might have referenced it, actually, that it is, it's there, and people can actually use it on a, you know, they can use it throughout the week. But even Lyngby, right? Lyngby just have a few cabins, they have a few benches, they have some heaters, they have some coverings, and that's it, and they sell local beer, and people can sit for a few hours before the game, and they can enjoy other people's company, they can build up towards the game, right? And that, in the end, is a good thing for fan engagement, but it's also a good thing for actually making money as well, right? Which is kind of the crux of the matter.
The experiences that I've had, I've not been to any Danish games, but the German matches that I've been to, it is just prolonging that match day experience. And I don't know, I think the clubs kind of, maybe it comes down to resources, maybe it comes down to time and effort and money, but I don't know, if clubs feel a bit reluctant to kind of push for that kind of thing. Why do you think that there's maybe a bit of reluctance there from the club perspective?
I think a lot of it is down to the sort of mindset of this is how we've always done things, and I'm not criticising that at all. That, you know, I can totally understand why that is how it is. I think in a lot of Scottish football clubs it's quite difficult because a lot of people who do roll their sleeves up are volunteers and part-time staff, right? So it's hard to say that, you know, oh, they should be coming up with all these great ideas, but it's hard to imagine that if I went to a game at Albion Rovers, for example, or Forfar or Montrose, that there would be a fan zone set up outside the ground, or there would be a beer stall that I could buy beer in a certain area outside the ground, or there's going to be merch, or there might even be local music if you want to have that. But it could just be as simple as, oh, okay, we've got some benches, we've got maybe a TV there or something like that, you can watch a game, maybe the earlier kickoff in Scotland. So why is that the case? I mean, difficult to say, but I do think Scottish football probably suffers more than most in the sense that we do sort of do the same things, and that's what I meant earlier by, you know, the TV contract, that we kind of are plodding along doing the same things that we did 25 years ago, and until somebody breaks the chain in that cycle, the clubs and the league can't really grow. They can't really grow. They can't really go anywhere. None of the clubs can actually go and break the cycle. Do you know what I mean? So at some point, there has to be, you know, some kind of give or take between doing the same things we've always done and trying new things, right? And I'm not really sure the clubs are in that sort of mindset yet.
I think, like you said, a lot of it is kind of volunteer and kind of part-time and even unpaid kind of committee members almost at the clubs. I'm thinking a bit lower down the pyramids. I'm from Linlithgow. I lived there for a long time, and the Rose Club just outside of Prestonfield Stadium is open on a match day. It's open. It is basically a pub pretty much in the town, and I think obviously it's attached to the stadium, and it's just little things like that that go a long way for keeping you connected to the club, I think. And I don't know, maybe that is, it is only applicable for teams lower down the pyramid where they're a little bit smaller and it is more of a community feel, but I feel like there's definitely an opportunity there for some of the bigger clubs to kind of look at that a little bit and open it up. I think Hibs were maybe an example. I think they had behind the goals before. I'm not sure if you were aware of that at all, Ross, but I'm sure it was a kind of opening up a suite in the East Stand, potentially at Hibs, or one of the stands at Hibs. I probably got that completely wrong, but I'm sure it was before a match, and it was just where you could go, and you could grab a drink there, you could grab a bit of food, and then you're already in the stadium before the match starts, and it is just prolonging that match day experience and giving you a little bit more experience of the club that you love so much.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, at the end of the day, you know, Football clubs, even though, yeah, they are football clubs, they're also, you know, media and event companies, right? They're there to have an event. They're there to try and make as much money as they can on a match day. And I think if you, you know, I think, we, and I'm sure we can compare it to the American sports, but I think at that level of finance, it's a totally different ballgame, right? You know, it's probably not really going to help anybody if we start comparing it to NFL or NBA. But I think if you look at it like, the minor league baseball is fascinating because minor league baseball has like hundreds of teams all over America in these tiny towns that you've never ever heard of before. But what they do is they create an incredible experience, right? And I don't expect Greenock Morton to be the Savannah Bananas anytime soon. People walking around with bananas on their heads, I do not expect that at all. But I think you can definitely say, okay, right, you know, there are opportunities there for people to come a few hours before the game. Oh, let's try and get maybe something connected to Inverclyde in terms of food. I don't know the restaurant scene there. I don't know if there's people involved in it, but they might come up with something creative, right? And over time, that might become a tradition, right? If you look at a good example is FC Utrecht in Holland. They have like this sandwich that's really, really famous. Like the stadium is just known for this sandwich. Don't have no idea what's in it. But what they did during the pandemic was they basically sent out like match day boxes before a game against Ajax. So everybody would watch the game against Ajax at home. But what they did was they created these little boxes where they had a sandwich inside it that the stadium's become so famous for. And they had like a stadium cup with maybe some designs on it. And they had a can of beer, right? Now, that's a really small thing to do. But what a great feeling that is when the club or an ex-player or a player turns up at your door and says, here's a present from the club, enjoy the game, right? Simple, but really effective.
Yeah, I love it. I think the one of the big things, and Duncan kind of touched on it as well, and when I was speaking to him, was the experiences that you get from some of these places, and you get little mementos even, and I think our clubs are, they could look into that so much more, because like I said, there's fans that absolutely adore their clubs and would do anything for them, and I think just to provide little moments like that would go such a long way across clubs in Scotland. I think if we could just do a little bit more of that kind of surprise and delight, and even providing wee things like, obviously we've touched on it and you can drink at the games in Germany, but I have like a big collection now of the plastic cups that you can get at German football matches and Austrian matches too. I've got a couple from there too. So like, I always think that like these are things that I'll keep now, and I know that I've been at those matches and I know that I'm a little bit connected to those teams, even though from that perspective I don't support those clubs. I just have that little bit of affinity with them because I know I've been there and I know I've got this little memento from attending.
Yeah, exactly, right? And there's obviously the sustainability aspect of it, right? So, you know, the clubs do make a bit of money from the cups, right, of course, but the one aspect of having these sort of not single-use plastic cups is that it helps with sustainability. Union Berlin is really, really big on that, and we've been awarded several times by the German government for, like, having a really sustainable matchday experience. So, like, even if you go to, like, buy a sausage, right, for example, you're not using ketchup and mustard out of every single little plastic thing. It's in a big box, basically. You know, the napkins are recyclable. You can buy beers in like small cups, but I think it costs you a bit more. So it does help as well with a sustainable agenda, right? So there's also the kind of non-football side of it that I think if you did promote that, I think given how socially aware a lot of young Scots are becoming, a lot of teenage Scottish fans are quite into that sort of thing now, so they would certainly buy into that as well. And I think, you know, it's a win-win for everybody when the club starts thinking a bit more about the footprint around the stadium as opposed to just let's recycle lots of plastic, right?
Yeah, that does lead me on quite nicely to the next question. I was speaking to Claire Nelson on the last episode of the podcast, and she touched on some of the areas that netball and the Strathclyde Sirens are doing to target the younger generation of fans. Do you think that's an area that Scottish clubs are missing out on currently? And if there's anything at all that you can suggest, how could they target that next generation of fans coming through?
I can really understand. You know, how intimidating it might be to come up with a strategy to deal with young fans, because I think if you're not in that generation of like millennial Gen Z, right, you probably look at a lot of the things that are going on with TikTok and Twitch and Snapchat and stuff like that and be thinking, what on earth is going on here, right? But I don't think the consumer behaviours have changed that much. Like, look at Mr. Beast, for example. You're aware of Mr. Beast, right?
Yeah, yeah.
The YouTuber, right? A lot of people probably won't. So Mr. Beast is like, I mean, I would say he's kind of like what Jackass was in the 90s, but certainly nowhere near as crazy or... put it this way, right? If you're a seven-year-old, you can watch it. But he does these kind of big stunts and, he gives away like $20,000 to people. It's just crazy stuff, right? But he's created a brand there and, he's now selling burgers. And all the burgers have these specially branded sort of boxes and things like this. Like you buy like a stadium cup with his face on it and stuff like that. And the younger generation still kind of is attracted to the same sort of habits as 50 years ago when it was the Beatles, right? Or 60 years ago when it was the Beatles. It's still the same concepts. Nothing's really changed. You build brand and then you can actually try and work on it. I think in the UK it's interesting compared to the US, and I do see a lot of people coming up with really crazy hot takes about Gen Z and millennials based on what the US fans want. Mm-hmm. But I think the sport culture is so different. And I think if you look at Scottish football in general, I've noticed this as well, but I think there is a wave of young fans coming to games. There are young fans coming to games, and there are young people who want that kind of traditional experience, let's say. You have Union Bears, the Green Brigade, the guys at St Johnston, the guys at Motherwell who have their own little singing sections. It doesn't really have to be like that necessarily, but I do think there is a wave of young fans who do want that kind of traditional experience. I mean, if you look at the EFL in England, which is often held up as the model for Scottish football, which I don't really agree with, but if you look at the EFL, right, their attendances are going up year on year. The EFL is kind of going through a boom because local youngsters want to connect with their football clubs. Watching games on TV is great. You can be a PSG fan, you can be a Bayern Munich fan, you can watch Premier League, but you also still want to go and watch your local team, right? So I think that's something that clubs can really tap into, that it doesn't have to be one or the other. All of these things can kind of coalesce against each other. You know what I mean?
Yeah, no, I definitely agree. I think I'm just thinking back to quite a lot of the examples that you've maybe seen from Scottish football this season, and yes, it's maybe not examples to hold up as kind of gospel, but you think back to some of the matches that you've watched and fans who've potentially, in small numbers, congregated around stadiums. And a lot of these fans are much younger fans. It's not, I was obviously watching the first leg of Airdrie against Morton the other night, and you could see in the corners at the Penny Cars or the Excelsior that some of the there was fans kind of congregating in these corners and trying to look into the match, and they weren't the older generation that's going there. They are fans that are wanting to get close to the club and see what's going on. And yes, they maybe couldn't get in the other day because there wasn't enough tickets for them to get into the match because obviously fans were back. But yeah, I think I've seen so many examples of that from Scottish football this season, where there is a definitely, as you said, there is a wave of younger fans that want to get in touch with the club and want to be close to the club. And I just hope that clubs are acknowledging this and recognising it, and then hopefully doing something to kind of create that connection almost that is going to last for future generations.
Yeah, 100%. Like, even if you look at the scenes outside of Firhill when they secured the championship,
it was
great to see like a lot of young fans there and engaging in their club, and I think that's absolutely brilliant. But the elephant in the room here is that right now we have a problem in Scotland that I would say the police maybe aren't as on top of it as they should be. They're using older methods. That, let's say, they're using methods that maybe you would use if there was drunk 50-year-olds in the pub. Do you know what I mean? Fighting in the street. I mean, we don't have to do that. And I think it can be scary for clubs, and it can be scary for authorities to look at it and go, oh my God, look at all these young people causing trouble. So what do you do, right? What's the solution? Do you take the point of view of this is unacceptable and we have to be quite sort of forthright and stamp down on it, and eventually people still do it anyway? Or do you lean into it a little bit and you try and create a culture where we can kind of live with it? We can kind of get on with it, right? You know, I think St Johnston's young guys had problems with the club, for example, because they were a little bit too boisterous. On the other side, you look at Motherwell, and I think Motherwell have handled it really, really well. The guys who are in there understand the responsibility that they have. If they cause trouble, it causes a problem for Motherwell, right? So they're almost kind of self-policing it a little bit. But Motherwell have created that environment. They've created a kind of a safe space where these guys can go to the game. They can get behind the team. They can be a bit boisterous. They can be a bit loud. But at least it's all done on a kind of unwritten relationship kind of thing. And I think you see that a lot in Major League Soccer, for example, in America, where they've got these sort of safe standing zones. They've got pyrotechnic spaces. Now, I'm not necessarily saying that that's what should come into Scottish football, because I think it's really difficult to manage. Mm-hmm. But I think you want to try and lean into it a little bit and try and create an environment where these people, these young kids, are engaged in the club, and the club wants to engage with them, and the club wants to sit down with them, and you know, whether it means that the police are also involved and they sit down and they, you know, we have a really open relationship. I think we need to look at it more, I think, from a point of view of, let's try and accommodate it, let's try and be open-minded to it, and let's just try and find the best solutions that we can to go forward with it.
Do you think it's, and again, obviously you're working in football, but do you think it's easier for us from a Scottish football perspective to comment on the game because we are kind of from the outside looking in?
Yes and no. I think, like we spoke about earlier, a lot of the clubs further down the league are kind of hamstrung by the fact that, you know, resource is a really, really big question mark. You know what I mean? Like, clubs just don't have the resources to come up with all these kind of ideas that we've spoken about. But I think higher up in the game, I think probably not, because, you know, a lot of these things, you know, what we spoke about with, like, you know, the policing, for example, right? This is a problem in a lot of countries. It's not just in Scotland, but I do think there is an element that football in Scotland is quite over-policed. And the sort of mindset is kind of almost going in and just lifting anybody, which I don't really like that, to be honest. I think we need a much more constructive relationship and a much more positive relationship when it comes to policing, because then if everybody's on the same page and everybody's working towards the same goal, i.e. a good matchday experience that everybody can enjoy and be safe and have no problems, then I think people need to get around the table and people need to try and be constructive about it. And I don't think that really has anything to do with, you know, being on the outside of football, right? That's also a society thing, that you want everybody to have a solution-driven mindset as opposed to being just critical and just trying to shoot things down straight away.
You touched on it there in terms of us from the outside looking in and giving some advice to some clubs lower down the pyramid. What would you pick out as some kind of bits of knowledge that you've learned from your time at Union or just from the outside looking in? What would you say to them?
Particularly in the lower league clubs, I would say really lean into your supporters, because at the end of the day, that sort of group of, like, let's estimate it between, you know, 400 and 1,000 people, these are the 1,000 people that are going to back you regardless. These are the 1,000 people that are going to come and watch you when you play in League 2 on a Wednesday night against some team from the north of Scotland or vice versa, right? You know, lean into it, understand what they want. It might be that you can sell more T-shirts, right, and make some money out of it. It might be that you can set up a small fan zone outside the game. It might be that you bring fans onto your board. It might be that you maybe change your approach to social media or to communications. I think at that level, and particularly, actually, I'd probably say, like, most levels of football, but I think particularly at that level, when you have a smaller audience, it's just so important to lean into it and actually really make the effort to go and try and engage with them. That'd be my advice to lower league clubs particularly.
Ross, if anybody does follow you on Twitter, they will notice that you do comment quite a lot on kind of how clubs are run, and we've obviously touched on that from a marketing perspective so far, but I do feel like these kind of two areas of football at the moment are quite similar. And why do you think clubs are maybe reluctant to look into more of the data side of the game and bring in some analysts? Because I know that that's an area you're quite passionate about as well.
I think a lot of it is quite structural as well, right? I mean, Scottish football for a long time has always been, you know, under the control of the manager, right? The manager signs the players, the manager picks the team, the manager does everything, right? And I think if you want to be a sustainable, ambitious football club, you can't really operate like that anymore, just because the game has so many more moving parts. And, you know, there are good examples, by the way. It's not all terrible. Look at Hibs, for example. Hibs, I think, in the last 18 months or so, have done great work. You know, Graham Matthew, the sporting director, I think is a shining light for Scottish football, actually. Jack Ross has come in and been the head coach and done really, really well. And what you have at Hibs is a really joined up sort of way of looking at things. They look at analysts, they look at data, they look at where they can maximise every single opportunity. But not many other clubs do that. And, you know, we see this discussion on Twitter, right? I know that I'm taking this on a bit of a tangent here, right? We see this discussion on Twitter a lot that, you know, the old firm dominate everything. We haven't had a title winner in 37 years outside of Rangers and Celtic. How many clubs genuinely believe that much in their strategy or believe that much at the start of the season? Do you know what? We can actually do something here. Doesn't mean we have to win the league, right? But can we actually win a trophy? Can we actually finish in the top three? Can we get into Europe? Can we do something special? How many clubs do you think actually think like that? I'm not really sure it's that many. And that, I think, is the most disappointing thing. We can talk about the way to do it, and we can talk about the methodology, and we talk about the strategy, and everybody has their own opinion. My opinion is different from someone else's, and that's okay. But how many clubs genuinely, hand on heart, believe that, let's say, in 5 years, they could go and win the league championship?
I would like to hope that this season, and obviously we're recording this before the Scottish Cup final, but I would like to hope that this season shows that something like that is possible. You know what St Johnstone have done, you've mentioned them a few times already. You just touched on Hibs there, facing each other in the Scottish Cup final. What Livy managed to do to get to the League Cup final. You would like to think that those examples are being held up as kind of shining lights at the moment for clubs next season and going forward to try and put together something. Yes, not just win a cup, but like you said, challenge a little bit more from a league perspective too.
Yeah, I mean, people might think that, you know, the idea of someone else in Scotland winning the league is ridiculous. I don't see it that way, and I don't think Scotland exists in some kind of vacuum. You only have to look at other leagues to see that it is possible. You know, everybody looked at the Danish league and thought, Copenhagen and Brøndby, they dominated in the 90s. They had some of the best players, you know, say the Laudrups and guys like that, right? But they had great players. They were playing in European competitions. But what happened? People came along with different ideas. Nordjylland, with the Right to Dream Academy in Africa. Mm-hmm. You had Midtjylland, who have a very data-driven approach. And 10 years later, you have, in Denmark, basically four teams every season that can compete for the title. Look at Norway. Bodø Glimt is a small town in the Arctic part of Norway, but yet they've developed an outstanding academy. They have this kind of greater purpose of, we want to develop players from our region. They all want to play for us. We have a kind of underdog mentality. And what happens? They went on and won the league. I don't think it's ridiculous that clubs with stronger resources and stronger fan bases can't be like that. But there has to be it's almost like taking the model and flipping it around a little bit and saying, right, okay, we know what it takes to win the league. We need to get 80 points, 90 points. We need to score that many goals. We need, you know, this amount of expected goals, this amount of chances. And how do you then get to that point? I think a lot of clubs are a little bit away off that, challenging obviously for titles. But I think if you're a football club and you're not pushing every boundary you can, you're probably doing something wrong, because at the end of the day, it is professional sport. We always want to remember that, right? If you're not trying to be the best you can be, if you're not trying to go and win titles and win games, then what's the point? And I think, unfortunately, in Scotland, I think probably 75% of the clubs just exist to try and survive.
Yeah, I think it's, again, I think I want to caveat this too. I mentioned it when I did the Duncan Mackay pod as well, but we are saying these things because we want to try and inspire and push Scottish football clubs to that next level. It's not trying to be negative by any stretch, and I know you feel exactly the same, Ross, don't you?
100%, yes, exactly. It's not a negativity angle of, well, you know, everything's rubbish, you know, that kind of, because it isn't. There's a lot of things that are good, but at the end of the day, you've always got to try and remind yourself and look at what other leagues are doing, what other teams are doing, and try and take inspiration from it. And, you know, there might be a lot of clubs that are doing great work in the background that we don't know about, of course, that's always possible. But, you know, I think Hibs are certainly going in the right direction, and I think they're probably a shining light for a lot of clubs. But if you look across the board, I don't look at Aberdeen, I don't look at Hearts, I don't look at Kilmarnock, I don't look at Motherwell and a lot of these other clubs and think, you know, or they really believe they can go and do something special this year. And I think that's what we have to try and improve, give clubs that little bit of inspiration so that they can obviously develop their own strategy and try and be a little bit more pro-risk and try and do new things, whether it's with data, whether it's with scouting, whether it's, you know, looking at different types of players and trying to go and break the mould, right? And that in turn also leads to more fans being engaged in the club, right? So it's not just one or the other. I think fans relate more to a team that does maybe try and want to play attacking football, does want to try and score goals, does want to try and win trophies. And I think, you know, if you take St Johnstone as a great example, right, they've got a generation of fans now that have probably been never more engaged in the club than ever before. You know, a lot of young guys in Perth and a lot of young fans of St Johnstone will be looking at it and thinking, wow, this is incredible, right? And it might engage them for years and years to come. So I think it doesn't have to be one or the other. And I think the two things can kind of work together.
Yeah, I think that's why I always kind of, when the debates come round, like I said, about kind of looking at data and trying to improve yourself on the pitch, I always do link it back to off the pitch stuff as well, because I do think the two are so linked. I think you can make changes to kind of how you approach the game on the pitch, and that can totally lead to huge benefits off the pitch as well, from, like you say, higher engaged fans, more fans interested in the club as well. I think those two things for me have always been quite linked together.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And I think, you know, I think it's much easier to market an exciting football team. I know how ridiculous that sounds, the hot take, right? It's not really a hot take, but it's more easier to market a team that's exciting, it's vibrant, it's playing attacking football, it's innovative, it's pushing the boundaries. People respond to that. People respond to an underdog mindset. And I think when you look at St Johnstone, again, it's a great example. That kind of culture that you create does lead to moments that you can market, whether it's, you know, Ali McCann's penalty against Rangers in the shootout, whether it's Xander Clark scoring or almost scoring from the set piece to take it into extra time, whether it's Glenn Middleton scoring the free kick to get St Johnstone into the cup final, whether it's Sean Rooney scoring the header. Like, all of these moments give St Johnstone so much opportunity. And to be fair, like, you know, a huge amount of credit to the media staff at St Johnstone, because I think, yeah, you know, that's a club that for a long time didn't lean into that side of things. But I think if you look at what they've done over the last maybe year or two, they've gone from, I would say, like 0 or 1 to like 8, 9, 10, right? They've done incredible stuff there. So I think a lot of credit has to go to their media boys.
Totally agree there. And it probably leads me quite on nicely to, who do you take inspiration from at the moment, Ross, in terms of who you look at for your own job, but also who's doing some good stuff across football?
In terms of all people I'm looking at that are interesting, on the pitch, I would say that the ownership group of Barnsley and Oostende in Belgium are doing pretty incredible things with data. You know, if you think Barnsley is a small team in the English Championship, probably have one of the lowest budgets, but, you know, they're on the verge of potentially getting to the Premier League through the playoffs. If you look at Oostende, it's exactly the same in Belgium. They have both adopted a really data-driven strategy, and it's paid dividends on the park. They've just had a strategy and they've stuck with it and they've gone all in on it, and I think you've got to give them a lot of credit for that. Off the park, I think there's a lot of inspiration from what the Americans are doing in their sports. I know that we don't really want to Americanize football too much, but I think the minor league teams, for example, are really, really interesting. USL is doing really, really well. I think USL, which is just outside of MLS, is doing a lot to grow their sport, developing the facilities, developing the fan engagement, developing their kind of their marketing and stuff like that. And I think these are probably more contextual to Scottish football than, let's say, basketball or NFL. These are kind of smaller teams with smaller resources. But yeah, obviously there's not really one example, but I would definitely advise anybody to have a look at what certain minor league clubs are doing, even if it's just from a marketing or digital point of view. I think it's quite impressive.
Is there anything? Well, I was going to say, can you hone it down to one thing that you'd bring from elsewhere? And that could be in football, could be outside of football, it could be outside of sport even. But can you bring one thing from elsewhere into Scottish football? What would it be?
Very difficult. Very difficult. You're kind of holding me with a gun to my head on this one. What one thing that could be brought into Scottish football, right? Okay, I'm not allowed to say that the SPFL should have more executive control, right? Let's take that out of the equation.
Okay.
I think the fan zone idea is really, really interesting, and I think a lot of clubs would really benefit from it. I'm kind of staying away from the wholesale alcohol thing. Obviously, that's part of it, but I think having people more engaged in the club for a longer amount of time opens up so many other possibilities, right? I think it opens up so many possibilities with merchandising, sponsoring, but you have to get people's attention, and I think that's probably one of the biggest problems. So I think the fan zone idea would bring so much value to Scottish football, and I think the fans would love it, and I think it would keep them more engaged in their club.
Yeah, I do agree with that, definitely. Finally, Ross, it's been great chatting, but you were actually nominated, I feel like, by Duncan Mackay, for me to speak to you. You were on my big list anyway. I'll give you
okay,
that.
Okay.
But who do you think I should be speaking to next?
So, I'm a big fan of Formula One. I think Formula One does quite exceptional things. Obviously, finance helps them to do that. But I think if you look at Formula One, and a lot of the teams do really excellent content. But I do like what McLaren do. And obviously Mark Pride is the social media manager there. So I'd be very interested to hear the strategy at McLaren, how they've been able to build up such an engaged community. Like if you look at what they do on YouTube, what they do on social media, the engagement levels are just through the roof, right? They might not have the same numbers as say a Bayern Munich or a Real Madrid or teams like at that level in football, but you know the content that they produce, it really does get a lot of interest. Elsewhere, I mean, I'm very interested in things like Twitch, how football clubs can use Twitch to do new things. I don't know if there's somebody there responsible for that, but I'd be very interested to hear like what clubs could do using those kind of new platforms to actually improve the experience, right? Obviously, these guys deal with PSG and Arsenal and teams like that, but how do you bring it down to a level in Scottish football that would be actually something that you could go and implement? That'd be really interesting.
Cool, yeah. Well, In the first instance, I'll get in touch with Mark. I totally agree from a McLaren and F1 perspective, to be honest. I think even just obviously this season in F1, you've got Lando and Daniel Ricciardo from a McLaren perspective. That's like a content maker's dream, really,
yeah.
Isn't it? From
yeah, exactly.
If you take their personalities from Drive to Survive, yeah, I think that'll be good to speak
It also looks really joined up in terms of, obviously, like you said, like having Lando Norris and Daniel Ricciardo, who are, you know, really great in front of the camera, that's one thing, but they seem to make it really joined up in the sense that the content they produce for the team is outstanding, but, you know, they sell great merchandise. They engage really well with our fans, and on a match day, they have their own app, which is really, really good. So I'd be really interested to see like what kind of resource it takes to do that, and if they have any sort of if Mark has any ideas of how that could be actually applicable to Scottish football.
Nice one, Ross. Thank you so much for coming on. That was great chatting to you, and hopefully, somebody's taken plenty away from that.
Cheers! Thanks for the invite, and thanks for Duncan Mackay for throwing me under the bus.
Thanks for listening to today's podcast. I really hope you enjoyed it. Like I said at the beginning, you can follow Ross at RossDunbar93 on Twitter. Sports Marketing Scotland is at SportsMarketSco, and you sharing the podcast really helps others find it. So please do consider doing that too if you've had a listen. I'll see you for the next episode.